Tell us about Stochastic.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers for putting that program together and giving me the chance to present this work. Okay. So this talk will not so be about solving one particular biophysical problem. It will be more about concepts. And the starting point is to remember three basic facts about biophysical processes on the level of the cell or below. First of all, they are non-equilibrium. We know that. Second, we're dealing typically with small numbers of at least one of the species involved. And thirdly, and this is presumably not always appreciated, despite these processes are running under non-equilibrium conditions, we still have a reasonable notion of temperature of the surrounding cellular environment. So there's delicate control of the 37 degrees in our bodies. Okay, and if you take these three ingredients together, you get to my title. We have to talk about dynamics, because we're in a non-equilibrium. We have a notion of thermal, of heat, of temperature, and since we're dealing with small quantities, we have to do this in a stochastic fashion. And more precisely, I'll be talking about energy conservation along a single trajectory, and I will try to convince you that we can even talk about entropy production along a single trajectory, and some of the work is developed or has been developed with my two grad students, Thomas Speck and Tim Spiedel. So here is the outline. I'll first give you a brief introduction, and then I'll talk about two sources of non-equilibrium. One is mechanical non-equilibrium, mechanical driving, and this leads to stochastic thermodynamics for Langevin systems. And the other source of non-equilibrium are chemical gradients, imbalanced chemical reactions, and this will lead to stochastic thermodynamics for biochemical reactions. And towards the end, I will get rid of one of constraint and talk about stochastic dynamics more generally, because all these notions can also be applied to general stochastic dynamics. Now, if you look to the finer items here, you see some buzzwords which give a kind of subtext to this talk. There have been two exciting developments in non-equilibrium statistical mechanics over the last 15 years or so. And one comes under the name of fluctuation theorem. This was discovered in 93 by Morris, Evans, and Cohens. And they observed what they called second law violating trajectories, or entropy annihilating trajectories in simulations of sheared 2D fluids. And that led to quite some development. In 97, Yarzynski came up with a relation which was supposed to be exact beyond linear response, from which you could extract free energy differences from analyzing non-equilibrium work distributions. So this is another motivation for this talk, and I will touch upon these topics, and as you will see, they will emerge as a kind of more general setting here. But I'd like to develop it systematically, so I stick with this biophysical motivation I just described. Okay. So let me remind you on some very old stuff. This is the typical experiment in 19th century thermodynamics. If you push this piston according to some protocol, you typically apply work to the system, and we have the the first law energy balance. This work either ends up as to increase the internal energy of the system, or it dissipated as heat. And since the whole thing happens in a thermal environment of temperature T, we can associate dissipated heat with an increase of the medium of the system. Okay, so this is the first law. Together with the second law, which on this level is a postulate or a matter of experience or whatever, together with the second law, you find that the work you spend will always be larger, or at most equal, or at least equal, larger, typically larger than the free energy difference. That's the free energy of the final state minus the free energy of the initial state. An important quantity in the subsequent development is what I call the dissipated work. That is this part of the work which is irreversibly lost due to non-equilibrium effects. So that's the 19th century. Now suppose we want to do the same thing on a much finer scale. So pushing is hard, so let's pull. So here's a protein or polymer folded, and we want to now pull it according to some protocol. And we do it again, thermal environment of temperature T. So first question is, how do we define work? How do we define internal energy? And how do we define the exchanged heat on this level? Another example is here. That's my cartoon of an enzyme which transforms this red molecule to other red molecules, thereby changing its internal state. And this would be the backward reaction. So this is a mechanically driven process. This is a chemically driven process. Okay. Now, suppose we have defined the work, because the whole thing is small and it's in the thermal environment, we can expect that even if we fix the protocol, that means how we go from here to there, that we have a whole distribution for this work. Well, if we have a distribution for the work, we might also have a distribution for the heat. And now remember the previous slide, since heat is related to entropy, we might even have a distribution for the entropy. Okay, so this is one of the questions we have to explore. Such distributions can actually be measured, and presumably most of you know this experiment from Bustamante's group, where they stretch RNA hairpins mechanically by attaching them to these beads, which are then manipulated by optical tweezers. So if you do that slowly, this is the force extension curve, you get a blue curve, you go back, it's almost reversible. If you pull fast, you get these red curves with this pronounced hysteresis loop. And these are just many traces put on top of each other. For slow pulling, it's almost reversible. For fast pulling, you get this big hysteresis. And now they have looked at the distribution of work, and since they have, from these very slow experiments, they know the free energy quasi-statically, they can actually look at the distribution of this dissipated work, and these are typical curves here.
What's the difference between the three curves?
I was just going to explain. These three curves?
Yep.
Okay. So the difference is that this is the distribution after 5 nanometers of pulling, 50 nanometers, 25 nanometers. So you have an additional variable, which is the length of over which you have pulled, and the different colors correspond to the different velocities. And one thing you should notice is that there are events in the negative range. There are events where the dissipated work is negative, which means these are processes where the environment helps you. The thermal activation or thermal kicks are just happen in such a fashion that you do not have to spend all the work. You get, so to speak, some work from the environment.
Yes. The probability of what?
The probability. So you do this experiment. You pull with a certain velocity. Or can you measure the work?
Yeah.
You measure the work.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and then you do that experiment 100 times, and you do the histogram. Okay, and the histogram looks like this. That's the work minus the free energy difference corresponding to this 5 nanometers, which you get from pulling very, very slowly. Okay, so the bottom line is you can measure this distribution. I'll show you other examples from our Stuttgart colleagues where we have measured such distributions in a different setting.
On the x-axis, you have then...
On the x-axis, I have the work, or actually the work minus the free energy difference. On the y-axis, I have the probability that this work is observed in an experiment, if the experiment is done 100 times.
So what you want us to call this kind of extra work, that's the point. It's always an extra above what you would do.
Well, it's the work you have lost. Yes, it's the work which is lost. So the precise definition is the dissipated work. Yeah.
It's an explicit violation of the second law.
No, it's not an explicit violation of the second law. And I think papers which have this title, violation of the second law, should never have been published under this title. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll come to this.
So the work dissipator, how do you measure it? You need to know the free energy for that?
Yes, you need to know the free energy. And what they did in this experiment, they pulled very, very slowly, quasi-statically, and then the work corresponds to the free energy difference. That's how they did it. Actually, this experiment was, I'm showing it here only to convince you that you can measure such distributions. This work was the first experimental test of the Yashinsky relation.
This work dissipated is the work, so the force times the distance minus the constant.
This dissipated work is the work. Okay. That's the work which you spend minus the free energy difference between a final point and initial point, which is a constant in all. Okay, so this is 5 minutes, I think, the timeout. sorry. Which is a function of the extension, but of course it's not a function of the velocity because it's an equilibrium property.
Did they also calculate magnetic free energy difference thermodynamically by going to a solution looking at
No. Their reference was the quasi-statically pulling.
The nothing with this figure. I mean, these three different figures are corresponding to different straight, 5 nanometers, 15.
5, 15, 25, and the different colors.
Is velocity.
It's velocity.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Good. So, what was the context of this experiment? So, this is presumably the
only. I have a feeling we're just at a really important point. If we're not all together, each of us is going to get lost at a different rate. So you've said it supremely clearly. I'm not saying that, but is
yes.
Everybody totally comfortable with his distinction between what he's calling reversible and infinitesimal? And
you don't have to be at this stage. I will. No. This is still the introduction. I will develop it systematically.
There's so many questions here about what's being described in terms of an extra work. Is everybody comfortable with this? I have a feeling that we're not comfortable.
I have not yet precisely defined what the work is.
Yeah, no.
I want to do later.
Okay.
This is still the introduction.
No. That's why I want to stop you right now. The baseline is reversible work. Yeah.
The baseline is the free energy difference,
right,
which, as we know from the courses, corresponds to quasi-static processes, which mean no dissipation.
Great.
Okay.
So and that wasn't criticism.
No. I like to be interrupted. And I promised you yesterday it will not take longer than yesterday's talk, which was 2.5 hours. Okay?
And I answered you, that depends on us.
Okay. So I would now like question and please an honest answer. Who has not yet seen the Yashinsky relation? Honest answer, please. Okay. Just you. Good. So I'll do this slide for you. I have to make sure that you can see it. Okay. So, again, the same setting. We know that the work... Okay, now we have to talk about distribution. So the second law has to be formulated in an average sense. The average work for a given protocol, which means how I go from there, is larger than the free energy difference. That's the second law, known for 100 and something years. 97, Yashinsky wrote a PRL where he claimed that if you look at the exponential average of this quantity and you pull fast and you average this quantity, you still get an equilibrium free energy difference. And if you see that for the first time, you should not believe it. At least I didn't believe it. But it got me started in this field, and since then I couldn't leave the field anymore. Okay. And the idea was the average is a non-equilibrium average. You have to start at thermal initial distributions, and you have to do it for a fixed protocol. But again, it doesn't matter which protocol you use. Obviously, it's a relation beyond linear response. And if it's true, it allows to extract free energy differences from non-equilibrium experiments or from non-equilibrium simulations. Okay,
so
this is...
exclamation point over the equals, does that have a mathematical meaning, or is that just for emphasis?
Well, that was his claim, and he provided a kind of proof, in quotation marks.
I'm asking about the symbol equals with an exclamation mark above it.
Well, forget the explanation mark.
Do you understand the KT implicit?
It's beta is 1, beta is 1, KT is 1. Okay?
It stands for voice.
So what is, I mean, this is equal, right? If you don't like the exclamation mark, that was the claim. Well, forget it if you don't like it. I don't know what it means. It means that this is a remarkable claim, right? It's exciting. Yeah, it's exciting. I was surprised.
Well, symbolic manipulation.
Okay. Okay. So, I don't want to start a discussion about the Yashinsky relation at this stage. Why not? There is an ongoing discussion about its validity on the Kant-Mat. There are confusing papers around, even from very smart people. I'd like to show you later a framework where it just falls out that one, it's one special case of a much more general relation, right? And then we can discuss it, because then it will be clear what the basic assumptions are.
So
yes, please.
Have you verified experimentally?
Yes. Well, what do you mean verified? Yes, there were... Oops, what's that? What is this?
You must have stepped on the cord that was plugging in the...
Maybe you're out of venue. Huh?
No, it's perfectly fine here.
It says screen's open because
it's not detecting it.
Who knows this one?
The reversible fluctuation.
What is this?
No.
I mean, it worked perfectly well, actually.
Something's going to happen in 5 seconds.
No, I know. It's not even responding to...
Oh, here we are. So what did you do?
I just hit the menu.
Okay, good. So I'll... Okay, fine.
Before you leave,
yes.
It's review. Could you
yes.
comment on this thing that Attila Szabo did recently?
Hammer and Szabo.
Yeah. This
was then an application for single molecule pulling experiments. I'll comment on this later because it also would pop out as one of my general formula. However, I did not. No, I think I'll have it in here. Yes, we'll come to that. Yes. Was it verified experimentally? But the experiment I was just describing was an attempt to verify it. And it was verified within an error bar of 1 kT. But I'll show you our experiments. There are now many verifications of it. There's another important different issue. It's an average, and the question is how many experiments or computer runs do you have to do? And this is problematic, as the experts here know. Okay, so this is the introduction. I would now like to come to the systematic development. And what you should have in mind are mechanically forced experiments. And my claim is that you can understand everything by looking at the very simple case. And the simple case is just 1 degree of freedom. 1 degree of freedom, so think about a colloidal particle in a potential. So you have the particle, we have this red potential, and on top of the potential we have a force which we can apply directly to the particle. This is an important distinction, in particular if you're in higher dimensions. So the potential would be conservative, the force would be non-conservative. Everything is overdamped, so the equation of motion is the Langevin equation, where the mu is the mobility and zeta are the stochastic forces. The total force is the sum of the gradient of the potential plus the little f, which I apply directly to the particle. Both the potential and the force can depend on an external parameter, lambda, which I drive according to some given experimental protocol. This, for instance, would be how I move the base of an AFM. Right? Okay, so the stochastic noise is correlated, it's Gaussian, it's white, it has a strength D, and I assume the Einstein relation to be valid, which relates the strength of the noise with the mobility. That's an assumption. That's an assumption as soon as we leave equilibrium. The validity of the Yajinsky relation relies on this assumption.
My old advisor from Compton would have seriously questioned this assumption
yes?
for a nonlinear potential.
Yes. Even in equilibrium?
Yes, for a nonlinear
okay, well,
potential.
Yeah, well, there he's pretty much alone, I guess. But you can definitely question it under non-equilibrium conditions. Now, what you can always do is, as long as you keep the white noise, you could always introduce an effective temperature. If you have D given and mu given, and you can, right? And all the mathematical statements go through, which I'll be presenting.
So, sorry to keep pushing you, but...
No, that's okay.
Udo, if you near a phase transition where the system is nonlinear, this assumption of Gaussian noise isn't right, actually. It gets renormalized and it gets a different color.
Well, it depends. I mean, my advice in this case would be, you know, just include all the degrees of freedom, and then obviously after you integrate them out, you get for the remaining ones memory effects and everything. So my approach is, if you include everything in the picture, that's a very reasonable assumption to have white noise.
Okay.
Okay, and we can talk about this relation. This is an important point, and that's why I don't want to sweep it under the rug. Because if you follow me here, Jasinski's relation is an identity. If you don't like the Jasinski's relation, you have to criticize these equations, as you will see. The rest is math.
Don't like Jasinski, you have to criticize
those two.
You mean criticize the use of that Schroeder?
Well, if you buy these five lines,
yeah,
you have to buy Jasinski. I'll prove it. So this whole debate under Kant-Matt is partially futile. Okay. So this is Gaussian white noise. So we know we have a weight for the trajectory of the noise. Of course, we're not interested in the noise. We're interested in the trajectory of the particle. You replace the zeta by the Langevin equation, you get the weight for the particle trajectory. And this, I think, is trivial, but it's important. In equilibrium, you're used to associate with each microstate e to the minus beta ei. Here we are dealing with dynamics, so the basic players are not microstates, but rather whole trajectories. And this is e to the minus, this is a weight for the trajectory. This is driving me. Okay, this is too fast. Okay. So this is something you should keep in mind. We're dealing here with trajectories, with histories, and we have a weight for each trajectory. Okay. Let me now briefly classify the different situations which you can discuss using this very simple model. If there is no little force, and if there's a time-independent potential, we are just equilibrium conditions, we have a Gibbs-Boltzmann distribution. If we have a constant potential, constant in time, and a constant but non-zero force, we have what we call a non-equilibrium steady state. That's the simplest class of non-equilibrium phenomena, and that's the setting where typically the fluctuation theorem is discussed. If we have no force, but a time-dependent potential, we can drive the system from one equilibrium state to another, and this is exactly the Jasinski setting. If we have time-independent potential and a time-dependent little force, we can drive the system from one non-equilibrium steady state to another one, from a slow circling to a fast one. And that's what was addressed by Hatano Sasa in a beautiful paper a couple of years ago. We can look at periodic driving, and I'll show you experiments we have done in Stuttgart under these conditions, and the general results I'll be deriving hold even for arbitrary time-dependent velocity and force. Okay, so much for classification. We want to do stochastic thermodynamics, so we need a first law. And I think Sekimoto might be the first one who pointed this out. So the idea is very simple. We just rewrite the Langevin equation in the form of a first law balance. Applied work ends up as change in internal energy or is dissipated as heat. So what is the applied work? That's easy. If you apply a force directly to the particle, force times displacement is applied work. So here's now my definition of the work. But if we change the potential, even if the particle stays at one point, if we lift the potential, this is also work. This is external work. So the total applied work is the sum of those two. Internal energy is clear. That's just the position of the particle in the potential. And if I want to make the first law work, the difference has to be the dissipated heat. And the dissipated heat, if you now plug that in, it turns out to be the total force, the sum of the two forces, the total force times the displacement. And that's exactly what you would have guessed naively. This is the total force times the displacement. This is just friction. Matthew?
There's an F plus grand V dx?
The capital F, yes, the capital F is minus dV dx plus the little f. That's a total force acting on the particle, right? This bracket here. I'm sorry, I'm somewhat uncomfortable, but if you move further over there, you have a better point of view. Okay, now if you plug in the Langevin equation, you get this expression. You see obviously explicitly that depends on the stochastic forces, and that's now important. We can relate this dissipated heat to an increase of entropy of the surrounding medium, because we've got the temperature of the surrounding aqueous solution, and that's an increment in the entropy of the medium. Adrian,
well,
yes?
I'm getting a little nervous. Am I in the presence
yes.
of a card trick or what? I don't know. But
presence of what?
Of a card trick?
Yeah. Oh, no, the tricks will come later.
Uh-huh. I'm nervous. Just say it.
Yes.
Any bit about this innocent looking lambda. I mean, X
yes.
can understand them pulling something, but lambda is something,
Okay, lambda is T.
Yeah.
Okay, lambda is T. Suppose I pull in a time dependent fashion.
Yeah. Okay.
Suppose I change the potential in a time-dependent fashion.
And this is you as the god who also changes
yes.
the X.
That's me. That's the god, and the DX is actually that happens in the system. I have no control over the DX. That's what happens in the system. But I have control over how I apply the force, how I apply the potential, and how there is. You see, this whole thing is so general. You can. It will also apply if you have no time dependence, whatever.
Right. If lambda is lambda is not a thermodynamic parameter.
Lambda is an external Lambda is an external control parameter. Suppose you do an AFM experiment. You have an optical trap. You have a potential V, okay, and you move that baseline. Let's see, this is a V of X, and you move the baseline. So you have a V of X and lambda. Would be the strength of the trap, x minus the position of the base, right? And this lambda would be velocity times t.
Can you quickly and explain this formula for the applied work, the second term, dv d lambda d lambda?
Yes.
Okay.
Suppose the particle rests here. And suppose the particle is in an elevator. It is lifted by the elevator. If the potential increases externally, this is applied work.
Yeah, so if it's a thermodynamic parameter, I'm happy with it.
No, it's not. We don't talk about thermodynamics. It's a mechanical control parameter. Okay. Suppose I move the optical trap. This is an experiment we'll do later. I move the optical trap, so the potential is centered around the position of the optical trap, lambda. And if I move the trap with V times T, right? And if now the particle climbs up here, I have to spend work.
The second term is the work done by this external, by moving your stage or by...
Yes, by moving the stage, by moving the base.
Could be magnetic field or electric field or things that were...
Well, I think electric field would be more like force directly on the particle. Actually, I mean, you can shuffle around things here. You can shuffle around things. This has to be conservative for later. For any fixed lambda, this has to be conservative. This can be non-conservative.
Is lambda really a parameter, or you can consider it as a V as a functional of lambda, which lambda is also some kind of function rather than a parameter?
Lambda is an external, I mean, lambda is determined by how I do the experiment.
So it's a symbol or really parameter? Is it a number?
It's a function. It's a function of the time.
Function.
Lambda is a function of the time.
And the only time. Or maybe also something else. Space, maybe, whatever.
No, not space. No, not space. Not space. Definitely not space.
But you don't want it to feedback with your where the colloid is. Right?
Do I want the lambda to be an X, dependent on X? No, I don't. What might be interesting, I haven't thought about it. Might be for the present lecture, I don't want that.
So to keep your... You move your laser a little bit, and you have a little bit of extra work to move it, that's
yep.
what we should be thinking about?
That's one part you should be thinking of. Yes?
But what you just said is that the shape of the potential in space doesn't change. Only its position...
No. It can. I mean, you know, you're free. You're free, for instance, here, you're free to make the stiffness time dependent.
Okay.
That would be another K of lambda of T. Okay. You just parameterize your potential with some parameters, and all can be time dependent. I don't care. As long as you know what that time dependence is.
I think one confusion is that there's no term like minus dv dx, but that's because it's a conservative force for fixed lambda. It doesn't change the energy of the system. There's no term minus dv dx.
There is
applied work.
Well, No, but if you look carefully at this difference, you see a dvdx. Dvdx is here, so actually it ends up here in the heat.
In the internal energy, right. So,
sure. Yeah.
So it's part of the internal energy, which is the kinetic and potential energy.
Well, dvdx is the force, is part of the force, and whether this force, where this ends up, depends on this balance.
But in here, you've written it in the internal energy, because dv there is dvdx times.
Yeah, you can write out the differential, and then you see one term is here, and one term is here in the heat. So this is, I usually say this is something Einstein could have done, right? But Sekimoto, I think, was the first who did it. Okay, let me now show you a experiment which we did in Stuttgart to illustrate this concept. So this is an experiment done by Clemens Bechinger and his co-workers. So the idea is very simple. We take a colloidal particle and we push this colloidal particle towards a hard substrate. And it's interacting electrostatically. There's electrostatic repulsion between the colloid and the particle. And the trick is that we can modulate the gravitational constant because the gravitational constant is applied by another laser. That's a laser which pushes the particle towards the substrate. So at fixed laser intensities, you get a potential like the black one here. This is the very strong repulsion, and this is an attraction. And if we increase the laser intensity, we can modulate or we can change the strength of the gravitational constant. Okay? So that's for fixed laser intensity. But what we now can do, we can now modulate the laser intensity in a time-dependent fashion. So what they do is take the particle, push it towards the wall, release it. Push it towards the wall, release it. Push it towards the wall, release it. They measure, they have very good control over the lateral, the separation. So we know the potential from static measurements. We know the potential very well.
By watching the fluctuation?
By inverting the Boltzmann distribution, yes. Sorry, I should have said that. We know the potential. We know where the particle is very accurately. We know all quantities which appeared on the previous slide, and we can look at this balance. And here you see it now as a function of the pulse number. So pulse is always pushing, releasing. You see the applied work. That's the black curve. That's for each pulse. So these are 200 pulses here. The red curve is minus the dissipated heat. The green curve is the position in the potential. And the black curve is the arrow.
The red curve is
calculated. Everything is measured independently from the trajectories and from knowing the potential.
How do you measure the heat?
Yeah. Well, we measured the heat. We did not measure the heat. I would love them to measure the heat with a thermometer. We measure the heat. Here is the heat.
Yeah, well, that's what Deborah was asking. So it's
yes.
Calculated.
Well, yes, it's, well, but we did not, you see, we did not subtract it from the other ones. It's assuming this interpretation of the first law. And then we can measure these three quantities independently, but all based on the trajectory. It's not a caloric measurement, obviously. Right? I mean,
then you know the potential and you know the trajectory, and
from that
you get
three terms.
Yeah.
And that's why we also get an error. I mean, if we did it, if we just calculated, if we had done it theoretically, we would have no error. This is the error. Okay? But the error is interesting. The error is about 1 kT for the sum of the three. So we have control of the individual terms with an error of about half a kT or so.
I'm misunderstanding. Is each of these pulses identically prepared and reproduced experiments?
I mean, it goes like this. That's the intensity of the laser. That's lambda of T.
So this happens throughout the different trajectories?
Yeah, it's stochastic. Sorry, I don't have trajectories with me.
What you have is x, yeah, or z, the distance from the surface.
Yeah.
Z is a function of time.
Yes.
Where do you get the noise?
You
average over the trajectory and you assume that zeta is related to
Well, you can always, you can replace the zeta by the left-hand side, right? So, you discretize this. You discretize the velocity.
But in Q, you
Well, you do it with the F. Forget this. You can do it with the F.
Okay.
and the F is this, this you know, and that this is zero actually, and this you know.
So why is the error, or what is the
infinity? Because we have got good experimentalists. I mean, what would you expect, 20 kT or tenth of a kT? That's just experimental error. I don't think it means something. It's accidental that it's just 1 kT.
Well, but that gets us asking, so this is the kT in your measurement apparatus?
No. Oh, well, okay. It's a good question. I don't know. Look, the important point is we're talking about 10 kT for the work and 10 kT for the heat. That's the absolute value, and that's the error.
That would be fluctuation of electric double layer. This is all of the order of KVT, so the potential is not, it's itself fluctuating. Yeah.
I mean, we didn't push it. I don't know. You know, we could have. We did not explore that, but it's certainly an important issue. Yeah. So Clemens Bechinger should be here. Okay. So much for. Yes, 200 times. I mean, I think they did it 10,000 times, but here we have shown it just 200.
What was the frequency of this oscillation?
I think milliseconds.
Okay.
I hope I'm right. I would have to look it up. I don't remember.
I mean, that everything has time to adjust to that. I mean, in terms of
the velocity certainly adjust. Velocities are equilibrated.
This was in vacuum or in a fluid?
Oh, this is all in a fluid. We're doing biophysics here.
Okay, so how about hydrodynamic dissipation? Is it obvious that it's
off? Good issue. Actually, for the analysis, we included a Z-dependence hydrodynamic friction, diffusion coefficient and mobility. But this is no, you look it up in Happel and Brenner, and we had to do that for agreement.
And you know all these horrible problems of hydrodynamic interaction with walls and stuff?
Well, as I said, I mean, a semi-infinite thing, it's for a sphere, it's pretty much under control. But it's, yes. By the way, everything I'm going to say is correct, even if the D depends on X. So hydrodynamic interactions are included, but I don't show it in the formula. Okay, so this was, I will break my promise. this was the first law. This is all not my stuff, right? Now let's come to the second law. And the crucial notion here is the idea of time reversal. And it's pretty simple, the idea. Suppose we have given now in this previous experiment this blue trajectory, x of tau. And we have some protocol lambda of tau, the Pluhmann. And now I define, it's a definition, I define the time reverse trajectory x tilde of tau, which is just the mirror image at half the time, total time of the blue curve. That's the red one. And also define the mirror image of the protocol. That's what I can do. And then I can look at the weight of the blue forward path divided by the probability that the red backward path happens under the backward protocol. This I can do. This is just a mathematical exercise. These are the two path integral expressions. I work it out. Most of the stuff cancels. And it turns out that this ratio is given by the exponent of the dissipated heat in the forward path. And this makes a lot of sense. Suppose you have a potential like this, and you are here on the hill, and you fall down. Then there will be lots of friction, lots of heat dissipated. The reverse process, where a particle moves upward, is very unlikely. So whenever you dissipate a lot of heat in the forward process, the reverse process is very unlikely. That's how you can interpret this.
I would be written down exponential, the free energy difference between the two states.
You would have.
Yes.
Yeah, that would have been wrong.
Yes, why? I failed the exam, but tell me why.
I'm not starting here in an equilibrium distribution. I'm starting, I specify the initial point, x0. So you should, on this level, on the level of a single trajectory, you shouldn't do free energy. It's just the weight for this particular trajectory. We'll have to later, of course, we have to average over the initial points, and then it's more closer to what you had in mind. Good. Okay. So.
So I can ask them, what about, so this picture here, it's inertialess.
Yes, overdamped.
Overdamped. So what would inertia, how does...
Currently written up. Not a lot. Not a terrible lot. Works. Yeah, not a terrible lot. But you see, for these applications, we can always deal with overdamped.
If you have inertia, then you have to reverse your velocities as well.
Yeah, right. You just do it.
When you go back.
Yeah, you just do it and it works out. It's okay. Now this is now the conceptually most important slide, and this is presumably the slide which will be criticized most. Okay. The idea is to introduce this notion of stochastic entropy, and for that I have to remind you on the third equivalent treatment of this Langevin dynamics. You can either look at a Langevin equation, you can look at a path integral, or you look at the Fokker-Planck equation, which gives you the probability to find a particle at time tau at position x. And this probability changes due to, it's a probability, so it's conserved, so you have this current j. Most people here in the audience would agree that this is a reasonable definition for the non-equilibrium ensemble entropy, where we have time-dependent situation, either because we have time-dependent forces, or even at constant forces or fixed forces, we can look at time-dependent relaxation from a non-equilibrium state. Okay, not everybody might agree. I know people who do not like this. But
those people who don't like it, how do you describe the limits of x?
The limits of x?
Yeah, how do you describe sampling of the entire set of possibilities?
Well, I mean, hold on. I mean, of course, for this equation, you need an initial distribution. Okay? And then you can just solve this, and you just do that. I mean, this is PLNP. That's the Gibbs entropy. So in equilibrium, this would be independent of tau, and it would just be the equilibrium entropy. Right, minus PLNP, and the sum is that sum over the microstates. Okay. But if you look at this carefully, you see that you can write it as a non-equilibrium average over quantity little s of tau. And little s of tau is tricky. Little s of tau you get by plugging a stochastic trajectory x of tau into your previously obtained solution of the Fokker-Planck equation. This is a well-defined procedure. So you first solve the Fokker-Planck equation, and then you take one of your favorite trajectories, or your unfavorite ones, whatever, the one you observe in the experiment, you plug it in here, you get a trajectory-dependent fluctuating quantity S of tau, which is of a very ambivalent nature. It knows about a particular trajectory, but it also knows about the whole ensemble because you feed it into the solution of the Fokker-Planck equation.
Wait, this average needs to involve a path integral, right? You need to actually integrate over all single trajectories, x.
Yes.
So you mean there the average of little s is a path, you know, a path average over all trajectories, or is it just a regular x average?
Well, you see, you can since you have solved this, and this is local in time, you can just do it as the average with this weight.
With the ensemble.
No, not for a particular trajectory. No, no.
So it's path integral. Well, to solve P,
you need to solve the Fokker-Planck equation, and you can do it however you want to do it. I don't care. But once you have the P of x and tau. This is well defined.
I'm yes. Confused by both definitions.
That's
the top definition there is a kind of entropy that doesn't obey the second law, right? Because we can specify the initial p
yes.
as a uniform.
Fine.
And evolve it, and it can only the entropy will actually go down.
Yeah. Yeah. For this, you have an H theorem. For this, you have an H theorem. H theorem. This always decreases towards the equilibrium distribution. for time-independent situations.
So it's a kind of transition between speech to grammar here, you know? That was speech when we did experiments and we could tell each other what we knew.
Yes.
But you want us to use the same words for something that
yes.
we taught early on in our life to be very careful.
Yes, yes, yes.
So
yes.
obviously we're being very careful.
Yes, yes.
So you want us still to use the word entropy, you still want
okay,
to
I will.
Yeah.
Okay, okay, good, very good point, Adrian, thank you. I could have called this thing why of Tor.
Yeah.
I still have to tell you why I call it entropy, right?
Good point.
That's a very good point. I hope to do that within the next two slides. I'll show you that this quantity obeys beautiful relations which you would exactly expect from a reasonable entropy.
For the moment, we can think of these as definitions, right?
Yeah, this is why I had, this is
the
three.
Definition is right what you do.
Yes, yes. Okay.
We've already learned another definition for that thing.
Okay.
So we're not calling a little s an entropy. It's
I call it an entropy, you can call it y of
tau. The big s you call an entropy.
The big s is the ensemble entropy. And the little s is my new invention. I call it the stochastic entropy.
So the confusion here is that normally we think of entropy as a thermodynamic
quantity. As an ensemble property, yes.
Stochastic by
yes,
so
right,
now
right.
We're going to sit in a fuzzy mesoscopic world where both we have fluctuation and
yes.
only we have thermodynamics.
Yes, yes. Right, Robin. That's why it's exciting. That's why it's exciting.
But you're just taking an expectation value of the last.
No, I will. Yeah. Well, if I just did this, I wouldn't have to go through that.
Yeah.
I will do more than that.
So, could you explain again the nature of that average of the last to get the S?
Okay. I second line, but I'll try to do it differently, Meredith. So we run the experiment. Time t.
You take many trajectories.
I take many trajectories, and for each I plot s of tau, right?
And then you average.
Okay, and then I do the average, but I can do that. I can do that easily once I have solved the Fokker-Planck equation. Okay. So, here comes why I think that's a good definition. This is the previous slide. Oh, that's true. That's true. I didn't look. Yes, I was sidetracked advertising the concept. Okay, so I have a definition. I can look at its equation of motion. That's trivial calculation, but it's interesting. Time dependence of this object has two terms, and the second term is force times displacement. That's what we have previously defined as the entropy change of the medium. And I remind you, mu divided by d is just 1 over kt, so that's... Right? So this is the entropy change of the medium. This is the entropy change of the system, of the particle. Hence, the big bracket here has to be the total change of the entropy of the universe. This is the entropy change of the system. This is the entropy change of the medium previously defined, previously identified. Not defined here, but previously identified. So hence, this bracket has to be the total entropy change of the universe.
Wait. But when I called that little s of t, for some of us, was just y of t.
Y of t?
Yeah. So we don't. You have to tell us that it's the entropy.
Yes.
Now you're saying that this is the entropy, so S total is some other entropy.
Yes, you're right, I was cheating. Okay. I will now convince you that this is the total entropy.
Okay.
This we have identified before, and from this you will see that Y of tau
okay.
is a good...
So you basically have to convince us that S total
yes.
is...
Yes, this will be the next slide, which I was so... You're right.
The medium entropy we identified before was an ensemble entropy.
No. The medium entropy, before we have defined the exchanged heat, but remember, this was a stochastic quantity.
Friction.
Okay. That was a stochastic quantity, so this is stochastic. This was identified as a stochastic quantity. Okay, so this is a technical slide. I'll try to get you through that. Okay, the bottom line is what we want to do is I want to prove a general relation. One is this non-equilibrium bracket. average. How do I do that? So this is based on previous ideas by these people. Suppose we start with a normalized initial distribution for the backwards path. So P1 is an arbitrary normalized function. And we propagate the backward process. If we sum over all possibilities, we have to get 1. This is just normalization for the backward process. I multiply with the forward probability, and I divide with the forward probability. Nothing happens. Whether I sum over all backward paths or whether I sum over all forward paths is just a renumbering of integration variables. But if I sum over all forward paths with the weight of the forward path, I get the non-equilibrium average of this fraction. The first part of this fraction I have just identified 2 slides before as e to the minus exchanged heat. Remember my explanation here. So this is the delta change of the entropy of the medium plus, and these functions I just put in the exponent as a logarithm. So we have proven that 1 is this non-equilibrium average. What about these two functions? P0 is the true distribution for the forward process which we should start, the true initial distribution for the forward process. P1 of x, of the final point, because the initial point for the backwards process is the final point of the end process, P1 is an arbitrary normalized function. This is a general identity for an arbitrary normalized function. And we will now exploit 3 different choices for this function, leading to 3 different interesting physical results. Okay, so I mean, I understand this is difficult to grasp if you see it for the first time, but it's not crucial for the following. Just buy it. Let's rather discuss the consequences. Let me now use as this arbitrary blue function the true distribution at the endpoint, the solution of the Fokker-Planck equation. But this is what I just defined as e to the minus entropy at the endpoint. So ln P naught is the entropy at the initial point. So with this choice, this sum here becomes delta S, the minus delta S, minus the change of the entropy of the particle. This is the entropy of the medium. This is the entropy change of the particle. The total exponent is the total change of the entropy of the universe. And the relation, this general relation says e to the minus total change of the universe is 1. And I think that's a nice relation. Because from this you immediately get, by Jensen's inequality, the second law. So this is one justification for my identifications. It was crucial to identify this term as delta S of the system in order to have the total entropy change here in the exponents, and only then I get this relation.
You make a jump with your stochastic entropy when average becomes the actual entropy?
No. No, this I didn't really say. I mean, this is what I get. And when, of course, if I now apply Jensen, yes, then I look at the average, the linear average, and then yes, okay.
So in your left hand, delta S total is the sum of the entropy change of the medium plus your stochastic entropy.
Yeah, this is the entropy change of the medium, and with this choice, this is the entropy at the final point, this is the entropy at the initial point, difference is the entropy of the system. That was one motivation for me to believe in that scheme.
You got the inequality.
That's Jensen. Jensen. E to the x average is larger than e to the average x. Okay, so it's what I call, it's an integral fluctuation theorem for the total entropy production. It's true, and that's important. It's true for any initial distribution. You don't have to start in the thermalized as in many other schemes. This is true for any initial distribution. It's true for any length of the trajectory. Of course, you can choose other functions here. You get other cute relations. Let me choose one particular function for this P1. I choose, okay, so for Yashinsky, I have to have no little force. I have always to be conservative for fixed lambda. I have to take as initial distribution the Boltzmann distribution corresponding to the initial value of the parameter, appropriately normalized. And for this blue function, I have to take the Boltzmann distribution corresponding to the final value of the parameter. And then you plug these two things in my master relation, and you get this, which is the Yashinsky relation. So this is the briefest derivation of the Yashinsky relation I know of. And it just pops out at a special case of this more general scheme. Okay. Okay. Adrian, you're not happy.
No, just magic tricks never run on specialty.
The average on the left?
Is a non-equilibrium average with the path integral. That's a non-equilibrium average. And I remind you, I have now defined what W is. I've defined the work. And we just do it.
And, I mean, this kind of result has no relationship with your this delta S total thing, which is derived from
things. They are two different things because I've chosen two different functions here. Here I have chosen the actual distribution. Mm-hmm. For Yashinsky, I have to choose the Boltzmann distribution, which belongs to the final point. This does not mean, and that's important, and that has been confused by a lot of people, this does not mean that I have to wait for the Yashinsky till I reach, in reality, distribution. It's just a mathematical trick that I have to use this distribution as a function.
Well,
yes, Robin.
Can you comment on one thing which always intrigued me about this? If you just take the logarithm of the left hand and the right hand side, it looks an awful lot as if this is some form of the partition function, where in the partition function you do a path integral over all possible configuration, and here you take all possible trajectories. It looks as if it's actually an extension of the standard definition of the free energy in terms of the partition function, where W is like the Hamiltonian over the change in energy along a particular
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's how you could interpret it, but I could not associate a deeper meaning to it at the present stage. Yes.
I guess I'd be smiling and happier if I had an idea when you knew that this wasn't satisfied, because we know cases where it's not satisfied.
Yes.
How it would show up in your criteria.
Okay, good question.
Actually, when do you know it's not satisfied?
Well, there are exact cases when people have found it.
Well,
get different answers.
Well, okay. So we could discuss these exact cases,
yeah,
but these are not in this setting.
No, but that's exactly what I want to ask.
Okay.
Is in this formalism, where would failure show up?
Okay. Failure would. I mean, failure.
We do know there are cases people carefully did. And
yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
so.
Blah,
well,
blah, blah,
blah. No. There is one case. If you take, okay, this is now sidetracking, but
I'm thinking a particular experiment.
Yeah, you pull, have it here, pull it out. You do no work. Free energy changes. It's broken.
Gibbs paradox.
Yeah. But of course, here you change the phase space, and you can modify the Yashinsky relation for this changing phase space. So here you're changing the rules. You're suddenly adding more phase space. This is a discontinuous potential. There is a nice paper by two guys whose name I've forgotten in the Journal of Chemical Physics just 2 months ago, analyzing this case. So in the Langevin setting, as I said, I mean, the only way out is that you don't like this relation between the strength of the noise and the mobility. You would still get... You see, you still get a relation of this type, but what you get here minus mu over d instead of this beta. And then you can no longer directly associate it with the medium change of the medium. But you still get a mathematical identity. But you cannot interpret it as easily as an entropy change of the medium if you don't like the Einstein relation in the non-equilibrium setting. That's where it fails. Otherwise, it's within the stochastic dynamics approach, it's an identity. Okay, I wanted to show you a brief...
Can you say something about P1 there again? So you said that in the Jasinski, no, P1, that's fine. No, in the next slide. Mm-hmm. So you have to choose P1 in a funny way.
Well,
so this one I don't. So how do you? So you have to say that P1. I mean, the way you get P1 is to invert.
It's just the Boltzmann. It's just the Boltzmann distribution at the end point.
Just saying you're going between two equilibrium states.
No, the whole point is that this is not the true distribution the system is at time t. But since this P1 is a mathematical thing.
Well, no, there's something extra about Jasinski. Jasinski does assume that your initial distribution, when you're starting applying work, it needs to be equilibrium.
That's true, for the P0. Yes. But you don't have to assume that once you have done the experiment, you have reached equilibrium, despite the fact that in order to derive it within my scheme, the P1 is the equilibrium distribution.
Yeah, what you have is a formula for V and a formula for F. Okay?
Yeah.
And what you're saying is that now I go to my final point, and I, in that formula, I put in X of T, lambda of T, and...
Yeah, yes, you're right.
But that formula is determined by the equilibrium distribution, which is the first one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that's the thing that I'm kind of...
Sorry, I don't get your point. I mean, I don't get the point.
Maybe a way of asking the question is there some physical interpretation of P1? Like, what does
no.
that mean?
No, there's no physical interpretation. It's a mathematical device. That's it. That's its beauty. You'll see another choice for P1 in a minute, and then we'll do a break. Good. Sorry. Yes. Okay. Let me show you just one example, which is now 2 years old. So very briefly, the idea is. Suppose you have a protein, and in simply-minded theorists' imagination, there is this kind of free energy potential as a function of, let's say, the end-to-end distance of the protein. So there's the bound state, there might be a barrier, there may be a non-bound state. Now I probe this protein with a cantilever, which is just a harmonic energy, and here you see this control parameter, lambda of tau. So the idea is, that I do this experiment, I measure the work, and I try to infer from this experiment, I try to infer this potential G of Z. Okay, we have been doing not experiments, but simulations, so you just simulate a Langevin equation based on this energy, and what we have done is we have moved the cantilever in a periodic fashion, so this is the free state, and then the system jumps back to the bound state, which is very narrow, so here the periodic modulation doesn't mean a lot, it comes out again, and so on. And with these kind of experiments, and many others have done a much better job, you can extract this potential from the data. How you do it? Suppose for my magic function P1, and X is now Z here, I just use a delta function at some particular point. I can do that. I plug that into my master formula, and I get the Hummer and Jarbo relation. I think this was asked previously, what this has to do with Hummer and Jarbo. Again, a special case of my general relation. Okay, and then we have just compared two things. We have looked at a linear loading, where you just do 100 times, you pull it over the barrier, and we have compared it with this periodic loading, and we have seen that if we spend the same time in the experiment or in the computer, the reconstruction based on the red periodic point is much better, in particular if you look at the error, than the blue ones. And at that time, we suggested that one should do these periodic forcing experiments. Okay, I think that might be
good break.
So actually, I've got 31, so we're at 16. So far, I've been talking about a situation where we have a time-dependent potential, but no little force which would break detailed balance at constant values of the lambda parameter. So whenever you have a little force, you have detailed balance is broken, and then it's a different game. But now we can look at time-independent situations and we still get something interesting. So imagine a given time-independent potential V and a fixed time-independent force F, non-zero. Then we get a steady state. In the steady state, detailed balance is broken. And then you can derive, using a calculation which is slightly more involved than the previous one, but not much more, you can derive this relation, which is a detailed fluctuation theorem. It says that in the steady state here, the probability to observe a trajectory where this much entropy is annihilated divided by the probability that the same amount is generated is exponentially small in the amount of entropy we're talking about. So typically you should think of this distribution. So P is the distribution. So if we look at delta as taut, you should typically think of that as having such a distribution. And this statement tells you something about the symmetry of these negative events compared to the corresponding events here on the positive side.
So Udo, in the beginning of the 20th century, there were these famous Loschmidt cycles, that if you start all particles in one point, then of course initially the entropy increases, but if you wait long enough, the entropy again will go down after sufficiently
yes.
long period of time. Can you apply, so you seemingly break the second law? Of course you don't. But
I think in my case they wouldn't, they would not necessarily go back because we're doing here stochastic dynamics.
Because you break explicitly time reversal.
I play time reversal. Yes, yeah, sure. This was e to the minus q thing here.
Right.
Yeah.
Your
yes.
delta S taut is not an observable quantum. You cannot observe it.
I think you can. I think you can. Yeah. Sure. Sure. I mean, we have. You can. I mean, you would have to measure the delta S, which I will show you at the very end, which we have done in another system. And the delta SM is easy. That's the frictional force. So you certainly can observe it. Okay, so this is not my invention here, I should say. This should be absolutely clear. This is the famous fluctuation theorem. I call it a detailed fluctuation theorem. It was, as I said, found empirically in computer simulations by Evans et al. In 93. Galavotti and Cohen have then proved it in a quite involved mathematical scheme using chaotic hypothesis and so on. Kirchhorn was the first to derive it in a stochastic fashion. There's a very nice classical paper by now by Leibovitz and Spohn on it. However, in all these works, it holds as an asymptotic statement for long times. With my definition of entropy, it holds for finite times. It holds for finite times. So it's a generalization of this work. It's a very general statement about non-equilibrium state.
Could you explain what's broken detailed balance?
Okay, broken detailed balance means, that's an important concept, yes. So in equilibrium, you know that the equilibrium probability to be in state 1 and to jump from state 1 to state 2 is the same as the equilibrium probability at being 2, okay? This is detailed balance. In non-equilibrium, we have a steady state distribution. We can be in state 1, we jump, and this in general will not be. Simple example, take a ring, no potential. Steady state is uniform with the force, but the jump, these probabilities are the same, but the jump probability to the right is much larger than the jump probability to the left. So the non-conservative forces break detailed balance in the steady state, quite generally. We'll see that in the chemical part as well. Okay. I have prepared two slides on fluctuation dissipation theorem, violation and restoration. My recommendation is that we skip these two slides and do it at the very end. We skip that as well. We do it at the very end for those who are really interested, because I want to get to that biochemical stuff earlier, as long as people are still awake. Okay, so the last. Let me show the last slide here on these mechanically driven systems because this refers to the earlier experiment. In the early experiment, we had this periodic driving, right? This periodic driving, And then you can show that you get a detailed fluctuation theorem for the work, for those times where the whole protocol is symmetric, which means that the protocol is mirror symmetric as before. And this is something we have experimentally tested. In the inset, we do the P of W divided by the P of minus W, the log of it, and you should get slope minus 1. But this is not my point here. My point here is a different one. This is the probability of the work. Remember this previous colloidal experiment, just some length of trajectories. This is the experimentally measured probability of the work. This is a distinctly non-Gaussian form, shape, and that makes a very important point. We can prove that the probability of the work is always Gaussian if we drive it slowly. That we can prove mathematically. That's non-trivial, but you can show it. The very fact that we observe here a non-Gaussian distribution shows that we are beyond linear response. Because slow driving is linear response, there we would get a Gaussian. The very fact that these general relations are still valid shows that this Langevin assumption is valid. Shows in quotation marks. So I use this as evidence for the fact that we have a regime beyond linear response where we can still use this Langevin approach. And that's important. Okay, so this is the driving, the speed of the driving. Zero, we have equilibrium. Here we have linear response. Here we still have Langevin. And these exact relations, Yajinsky relation, fluctuation theorem. I mean, these relations, in a sense, become trivial in the linear response regime. And beyond that, we have all the nasty non-equilibrium effects, where these things will break down.
So in the limit of slow velocities, you have a Gaussian centered on zero.
You have a Gaussian centered, not on zero. No, not on zero. You have a Gaussian centered...
on delta F.
No. The zero order term is a delta function at delta F. Okay, so here is W, here is P of W, here is... Okay, so in zero's order, you get a delta function. So in zero's order, P of W is delta W minus delta F. So do we... Okay? And in... first order, you get a Gaussian, which is centered not at delta F, somewhere off. And actually, because we have the Yajinsky, the variance and the mean are related, but it's not centered at delta F. That's a non-trivial statement.
But the center does not... go to zero in the limit of slow velocity?
It does.
Okay.
It does. It does.
So, Udo, let me understand exactly the statement which you just made. You say that if I have the rate finite, if a finite rate, there is a regime where the Langevin description stays finite. Now, specifically, suppose that I take a nonlinear mechanical system and I drive it. If I drive a nonlinear mechanical system hard with damping, I can get things like Shapiro steps and resonances of all kinds. Is that
included?
Take a charge density wave in an electrical field.
Okay, these are now many body systems, and I think we would have to talk about each specifically. This is not a theoretical statement. This is a statement based on this experiment. I cannot prove this. I take this as evidence, indicates existence, not proofs. I take this as evidence that this Langevin approach makes sense beyond linear response.
But even a single particle in a complex potential, if I drive it, I can get complex excitation phenomena and resonances, right?
Yeah, but you could still do with the Langevin relation.
This is a
particle driven in a non-trivial potential. It's just not your double well potential. It's this highly asymmetric wall gravitational field potential. But it,
So you believe that this would be valid for, let's say, double well potential?
I believe that it's in principle valid, yes. But don't force me to nail here these crossovers yet. So this is evidence. This is no proof. Okay. So now we are done with this
You kind of want us to remember this phrase because we think we have an intuition about Langevin that you'd kind of like us to hang on to.
Yeah.
But it's not like you're proving that it's exactly that, right?
No. Yes. No. But I mean, I like the Langevin equation.
Yeah, we know this.
Yeah. Yes. And so I'm happy for each piece of evidence which shows that it's more widely applicable than the strong Dutch school sometimes which suggests. Yes.
Can you talk about the number of experiments
You mean needed to get reliable? No, I will not. I think Chris Jarzynski will talk about it. That's certainly a problem. I admit that. Sure. Yeah.
It scales like what?
It can get exponentially difficult things. Things can be very difficult.
But it scales exponentially with the work performance of equilibrium?
I don't remember. I would have to look it up. But it's certainly, the practical use of the Jarzynski relation for determining free energy differences is questioned. You know, I mean, you can pull fast, but you have to do it very often, and sometimes it may be easier just to pull slowly and not so often, and Sean has done work on that. Okay, now I would like to leave this mechanical stuff. As I said, I have more on this, and we can talk about this in private or in smaller groups. But I want to come to something which is perhaps relevant also to the topic of this workshop. The idea is that we now do the same thing we have done for this mechanically driven system, where we have a clear notion of work, where it was easy to identify the work and the heat, that we do the same thing for chemical reactions in non-equilibrium. And here is my model. So this is an enzyme with different states, and I label the enzyme states with N and M. And this enzyme undergoes transitions, and these transitions involve some other molecules. So this could be, for instance, F1 ATPase, and this would be ATP, and this would be ADP plus P. Okay, so we have these alpha molecules which participate in the reaction, and these R and the S are stoichiometric coefficients. As before, we have to assume something about the dynamics, about the kinetics. And we'll do the simplest thing. We assume mass action law kinetics. So the ratio of the forward and the backward rate involve the concentrations of these alpha molecules. So the more of the red stuff I have here, if I have twice the red stuff here, I have twice the rate going this way. And of course there's some intrinsic part. I assume that the red particles are externally controlled or clamped at certain concentrations, and I'm
confused. Yeah. Mass action law kinetics. My understanding of the law of mass action is it's just minimizing the Gibbs free energy.
We'll come to that. That's equivalent in equilibrium situation. But of course, we want to do it in non-equilibrium.
Scale balance plus mass action law kinetics. Is that right?
If you don't like this word, just take this as you took the Langevin equation in the previous slide. Okay. So what I want is that the probability for this transition to happen increases with the concentration of the red guys here, and I want the probability for the backward transition to happen increases with the concentrations of the red guys down here. And I thought this assumption is called mass action law kinetics, but I might be wrong. Okay.
But is it assuming detailed balance?
It's assuming detailed balance if these concentrations are in equilibrium.
Yes, but didn't you just tell us that you don't believe in detailed balance?
That's true, but it's not assuming detailed balance once we're out of equilibrium, as you will see.
Or even concentrations.
Yeah, okay. As you'll see. Okay, so what about the concentrations? We clamp the concentrations, and then we have a chemical potential, which involves what I call the intrinsic energy of a molecule, and this is this concentration effect. Okay. And now let's go to Robin's favorite situation. We look at the hypothetical equilibrium. I can always choose the concentration such that the whole thing is in equilibrium. And then, of course, as Robin just pointed out, I know that this ratio is given by the Gibbs free energy difference. Okay, but then, of course, I have to choose here the equilibrium concentrations. So what is the Gibbs free energy difference? The Gibbs free energy difference is the difference of internal energy of the enzyme states. So we're talking about one transition here, this N-M balance. And, of course, it involves the net change of the number of molecules times the chemical potential. So, but when, with this, the point is that with these relations, we can now fix this unknown ratio of the intrinsic rates. And they turn out to be just given by the energy levels of this. Oops, it's always jumping one. by the energy levels of these involved molecules. So this is the energy difference of the enzyme states, and this is the energy difference of the partners in this reaction. So this is, by the way, I mean, this appealing to the hypothetical equilibrium has something to do with appealing to the Einstein relation in the Langevin case. This is the same, conceptually the same statement. Okay, so we have now fixed the intrinsic rates. And then, again, with these rules, everything is fixed. Everything is now fixed, and we just go on with the analysis. So the idea is that we look at the first law now along a chemical reaction event. I mean, a trajectory of chemical reaction events, so let's first look at the single step, this transformation from N to M. What is the work? What is the work? What is the chemical work? Well, the chemical work is just, these are externally clamped chemiostats, so to speak. So this is the work we put into the system. Okay, everybody agrees. Internal energy, again, is clear. That's just the energy level of the enzyme. Hence, the difference has to be the dissipated heat. Turns out this difference is the log of the full rates, which I then, with these under these rules, I can identify with the change of entropy of the medium in the step N to M. Right? And then I just sum over all reaction events, and I get change of entropy of the medium. A little bit as before, with the frictional heat. Now the question is, what is the entropy of the system? Because I need that, and then I want to get to these fluctuation theorems and so on. Yes. Adrian.
I don't even know if I can ask a question. I feel like I'm crawling up something in my grip.
Sorry.
So there's easy stuff and hard stuff.
Yes.
Easy stuff is like a lot of this and that for free energy and chemical potential of the red guys. And then there's this green guy who has an energy depending on what state he's in.
Yes.
Is this a deep statement or a non-deep statement?
This here.
If you don't harness all the energy that's stored in the difference in the concentrations, it's going to get lost in heat. Is it? Where's it going in some sense? I'm having an awful lot of trouble going from the truth to the abstruse.
Yeah. I hope to leave the abstruse as far away from me as possible. With the trivial, I have no problem. I mean, when we did this work, I was kind of surprised, actually. I mean, we screened the literature, and we may have overlooked something. I was surprised that I never, ever found a statement in the chemical literature where this kind of first law-like idea is applied to a single reaction.
Prigogine wrote down something very similar.
Prigogine did these things on the ensemble level. It has all been done on the ensemble level. I mean, of course, you know.
That's the point.
But I want to do it on the trajectory level because we can, as we have seen in this workshop, we can observe biochemical reactions on the single molecule level.
Think of chemical potential as a mechanical potential, and then replace everything with Udo did before the break, and then replace the chemical potential.
That's over. What's written there, an accountant could have written down, and I'm not sure what's going on.
Yeah, okay, I tell you something. Yes. This whole thing is much...
That's fine.
I enjoy your interruptions. This whole thing is more complicated than I'm showing it here. I'm sweeping some things under the rug I do not even mention here.
Okay.
And they will all be in a full paper just submitted to J. Kempfis.
Okay.
But it took us quite a while. I mean, we worked hard for 3 months to work it out. I mean, these statements kind of look trivial, but you have to show that they are consistent, right?
Yeah.
And we'll come to that for a simple case. And since if you do the whole formulas, you see what we have done is we have not done it just for one enzyme, but for a whole reaction network. And then the formulas just get that big. That's why I'm concentrating.
R minus S as d lambda, and mu as dV d lambda, right?
R minus S is
like
it's more.
And mu is like dV lambda.
No. The lambda is the mu. No. I don't want to do this. I mean, this is like a little bit like FdX. This is the work we put in.
Yeah.
That's dV d lambda plus FdX. Sorry. Yes. That's true. Yes. This is the internal energy as before, and this turned out to this was. To capital F times the displacement. But the important point is, I mean, I wouldn't have guessed, in the mechanical case, I could have guessed it. But here I just get it from this difference. I mean, I would never have guessed that this is the heat. Right? Okay, so now I think this is a reasonable statement on the first law, but we want to do thermodynamics, so we need something of the second law. We need an entropy. And now I want to step... back one step. This looks horrible, but it's not so bad. I will come back to this biochemical situation, but in order to explain what entropy is for these discrete processes, I will do it in a completely abstract way with the virtue that it's applicable to any type of discrete dynamics. And we had many examples during this workshop. Matthew was one where we had looked at this kind of dynamics. So for two or three slides, let's go back. I'll come back to the biochemical motivation, and let's look at an abstract dynamics on discrete states. So we have discrete states N and M, and we have a master equation for the probability change to be at time t in state N. This is a master equation. You can jump into the state with rates, and you can jump out of the states with other rates. And again, I allow that these rates depend on some external control parameter. Very, very general framework. Embodies, of course, then our biochemical setting. What is a stochastic trajectory? Well, it just jumps between these states at certain jump times. Tau 1 is the first jump, tau 2 is the and so on, right? So at times tau j, it jumps from nj minus to nj plus. Okay, you'll not be surprised that I define this to be the entropy of my system. I get this quantity if I first have to solve the master equation. That's Pn of tau, or t. And then I plug into the solution of the master equation, I plug in this specific trajectory. And then I get a stochastic quantity, exactly as before. Okay? I can look at its equation of motion. Exactly as before, I get two terms. Here I get a term which jumps only, which contributes only when the system jumps. And what you see here is the log of the ratio of the rates. This is the jump from backward jump, and this is the forward jump. Now I appeal to what I've just done in this biochemical setting. There we have seen that the heat is just this ratio. So I call it, even for this general setting, I call this the entropy change of the medium. This is the entropy change of the system. The whole thing here is the entropy change of the universe. Let's see what we can do with that for motivation, why I do it. I mean, I've given you one motivation why I identify this, because in the biochemical setting, I have just identified it on the previous slide as heat. Okay, no surprise, as before, same statements on the same conditions. Integral theorem for arbitrary initial state, arbitrary driving, arbitrary length of trajectories, detailed statement as before in a non-equilibrium steady state where detailed balance would be broken. Very general statements, true for any kind of stochastic dynamics. You don't have to talk about heat and temperature. You just take the master equation, you go through that, this is what you get. Any process you're dealing with has to obey these relations. And it would be nice to work it out for any specific problem you're working at. Okay, let me now, I want to illustrate now these things. I first want to illustrate this detailed theorem in a non-equilibrium steady state. What does it mean? What does it mean for an enzyme we know? You all know this F1 ATPase. This is this molecular rotor. If you look on top from top and you look at this gamma subunit, it basically has, in a simplified description, it has these three possible directions separated by 120 degree steps. If you look more carefully, Kinoshita has seen it's 90 plus 30 and so on, but let's stick with this three-level description. And whenever it advances, I now drive it in the hydrolysis regime, so whenever it advances one step, it burns one ATP, and the result is an ATP plus a P. Three equivalent states, this is the master equation. We have to start with the master equation, and we have equivalent, we have forward rate, and we've got a backward rate, K plus and K minus. Okay, and now I can work out this general scheme, just all this abstract definition, it's half a page of calculation, not much. And what I find as the total entropy change turns out to be N, that's the number of forward steps, times the logarithm of these two ratios. But it's exactly what you would do biochemically. That's the total entropy change, that's the free energy you burn, and the internal states are all equivalent, so there is no energy entropy change of the system in this very simple model. And then this detailed fluctuation theories, which was a statement about the probability to observe minus delta as taught, turns out to be a statement on the probability to observe minus n steps in the wrong direction. And you just plug everything in. This is the detailed statement now exemplified for this trivial example.
Are these the same rates that you measure in bulk? K plus and K minus, or they could be different from the bulk?
From
what you got from us?
Yeah, that's a different story now. I mean, I'm just assuming I know these rates.
Okay.
Though there are some motors like F1 ATPase which can run both ways.
And yes.
Usually in the language of non-equilibrium thermodynamics, you say in the on-cycle regime.
Yes.
And other ones are far from the on-cycle regime and only work one way. Are you assuming here implicitly that you are close to
thermodynamic
equilibrium?
No, I'm not. I'm assuming this validity of this master equation, okay. Not more.
And we assume that it is linear, right?
What is linear?
This master equation is linear, P1, P2, and P3.
That looks to me like the Onsager assumption in some way.
I mean, I'm assuming I have a forward rate and a backward rate, and this and you can be arbitrarily away from equilibrium. Look, Robin, I mean,
chemical reaction theory may or may not apply to these systems. Simple.
Sure. I mean, if you question the possibility that there is, I mean, if you say that there's not just one rate.
It's what Alexei said. That first equation.
Yeah.
It's linear.
That's a linear.
The mass equation is always linear in P.
Must it be always linear?
Yeah, sure.
But you still have some variables and some Markovian.
No. Hold on. Yes. No. If it's Markovian, then it's fine. But
well, some of these you'll have to introduce more variables and so on.
Right. But the mass equation is always linear. You cannot criticize the linearity of the mass equation.
But K plus or K minus not depends on.
Sure. Sure, you can. You could have a more. You could have k plus 1, 2, 2, 3, and you know we've done that. You can. That's not. It all works out, Robin.
I feel that you implicitly assume the validity of the standard chemical reaction scheme, which need not be the case for molecular models.
Yes, I'm assuming here that I have these rates. If I don't have these simple rates.
Okay.
Well, you can also not rate constant, but assume that transition probability. For unit time, what the probability of jumps?
That's my rate. Yeah. That's my rate. Of course, there could be substeps, or there could be waning times, and then you would just have to blow up the model. And then the statement becomes more delicate.
Some models which you could try to drive in reverse, they absolutely refuse to
switch. Yes.
And they're not described by
That's true. That's true. Yes, I agree. I'm assuming that to each forward reaction, I have to back up. Sorry, yes. But I think this is a statement which goes beyond the linear response regime.
So it's beyond Onsager theory?
Yeah, definitely so. Definitely so.
You can still deal with that by introducing more variables.
Yeah.
But these, the rate equations are not linear for those systems.
Unless you introduce more variables.
Right. We get sidetracked.
I have a really naive question,
yeah.
I'm afraid. Those chemical potentials, ATP, ADP, and these are bulk quantities, or these are...
Yeah.
So they don't depend on the motor?
No. I impose them externally.
But the rates, K plus and K minus, definitely depend on the motor, so...
You mean depend on the molecule?
Yeah, the equation just below.
Yeah, I'm not assuming that K plus is this. I mean, this is... You have to work that out. I mean, there are some steps in between.
I'm surprised that the log k plus over k minus, these are very dependent on the motor, right? And the different chemical potential are not.
That's the enzyme. That's this way of changing rate constants, not actually changing the energy difference.
Right. Right.
So the chemical potential depend on the enzyme.
No.
Only the function of the end states, not a function of the intermediate.
You see In this previous slide, this thing here depends on the enzyme. This here, this ratio. This depends on the enzyme, but this is the concentration thing.
I think Pierre's asking a more physical.
It's a very stupid question.
It's not stupid at all.
I have two sides on my equality. One side seems to be independent of the enzyme, and the other.
No, this okay. So this is somewhat misleading. Okay. If I do it the abstract fashion, I get this, and I get this. And now I go back to my biochemical slide with the mass action law, and I work out what would I get for delta S. And then I get this.
So this equation is valid?
This equation is valid.
Okay, so
if,
my question
is... Yeah, but this is what you burn. This is what you burn, and this is the heat. This is the heat dissipated due to the burning, and you don't care who burns.
Basically, if you're standing outside and seeing the rate of burning, that gives you the measure of it, because
right.
those are simply mu's to tell you how much fuel you burn.
Right.
Right. So
right.
The enzyme, you take a chemical reaction, ATP to ADP PI, it would happen in solution spontaneously with the free energy drop that's given by that. Difference there. But the enzyme will make it faster. In other words, it'll change the K plus and K minus. But the relative free energy of the reacting product is never changed by the enzyme. That's
it's like in a Carnot cycle, it only depends on the conditions
right.
of the initial and final state and nothing that goes on in
Okay, I have another simple example for that. This was actually the first I did. Yeah.
I'm a little mystified here.
Yeah.
So what have we gained from defining entropies and we just got the master equation and we can calculate all
You've got this.
And ratios by solving master equation. So what have we gained from new vocabulary?
You have gained this second law-like statement, generally proved. And you've got this detailed statement. And in order to get these statements, you have to use my definition of entropy. But of course, I agree. I mean, once you have the master equation, everything is set. There's no new physics.
Is there anything that I can calculate faster or better? Is there anything I couldn't calculate before that I can calculate now?
No. No, there are some things which you can calculate faster, but there's no new things which you could not calculate before. As I said, Einstein could have done this in the mechanical case. That's true. I mean, if you give me the master equation, as I had on this slide, everything is set. This is just an interpretation of certain terms, which I think makes a lot of physical sense.
But aren't you too modest? The second equation, can you go
further? I'm always modest, as you know.
Your last equation, that one is not normal. It's one I haven't seen before. And
no.
Directly experimentally tested.
Sure. But then you will, and then it will be obeyed, and then Boris will say, no doubt, because, you know, it's a master equation. And
my problem with this is that we haven't seen it before because we haven't seen the definition of delta as...
okay.
But the equation in the box on the previous slide
with a P or...
Yes, you have seen, I should have said this, sure.
Yes, this is,
I mean, by the way, you can of course, as you know, this is an asymmetric random walk. You can solve it exactly. It's in von Kampen's spoke. It's a Bessel function. Yeah, sure. This is a complicated way of getting this result, but it serves here as an illustration. It's no new physics. It's a framework.
So this is for a discrete walk, is you can show, but for the previous one, it's a generalization to that.
Yeah.
Therefore,
yeah.
We need to introduce this new form, this entropy definition.
Right. And people have talked about the fluctuation theorem. It was valid only in the infinite time limit because they haven't looked at the entropy of the system. You see, the entropy production in the medium is extensive in time. The entropy change in the system is usually bounded. So in the long run, the other one wins. But with this, you can apply it to short trajectories. Okay, one more little example. This is for Rob, dog flea thing. Simple isomerization. So suppose you have capital N number of molecules, which can be either in the X or in the Y state. We've got weights here. Of course, as long as the weights are constant, this is just an Ising model. But now assume that you can change the rates in a time-dependent fashion. Then for any fixed time, you have a stationary distribution, given where this ratio, Q here, comes in. You have a stationary mean. That's the number of molecules which are in the X state. And if you now look at this integral theorem, you get this kind of statement, the exponent, the trajectory integral, and here you get what then later Chris Jasinski called the non-equilibrium lag. So this is the actual number of molecules in the X state. This is the number of molecules in the X state which would correspond to the instantaneous value of the rates in the stationary state. So this is somehow how much the system lags behind. And this gives an integral relation, an integral constraint on this lag. And that's actually a nice follow-up by Chris Jasinski. So this is just another example how these integral theorems look like for a simple setting. And this was the first thing I worked out in this whole field. And with this, I went to my experimental colleagues and said, let's do the measurement. And then they came back somewhat later and said, how many molecules do you need? And I said, well, the fewer the better. And then they said, well, is one enough? And I said, sure. So, and that's with what I'll be closing this lecture. This is the one molecule case. It turned out not to be an isomerization, but some transition in a defect center in diamond. So the bottom line will be that this defect center can be in two states, and we can modulate one of the rates by playing with the intensity of a laser with which we illuminate this defect center. Okay, I think that's presumably enough of an explanation. Here is a term scheme and how it works in detail. So think of it just as being two states, and we modulate one of the rates in a sinusoidal fashion by modulating the intensity of the laser. So the output are binary trajectories. We can be either in state one, which turns out to be fluorescent, red, light, bright, or it could be in state two, which is dark in fluorescent. So we get this kind of binary trajectory. And that's all what we need from the experiment. And then we can, for this case, we have now measured this entropy. So this has a lot of information. I'll guide you through. So we modulate the intensity. So we modulate the stationary probability to be in one state. That's the green curve. The actual probability is lagging behind, as I just explained. This here is the trajectory. So here we are in the dark state, and so on. This is the entropy change of the particle. So there are always drastic changes of the entropy when the particle jumps, and there are small changes when the particle rests in a state, but because the probability of this state is changing, the entropy is changing as well. This is the entropy change of the medium. This jumps only when the system jumps. This here is a typical trajectory where the entropy of the medium, the red curve, slowly increases. This is an atypical trajectory where the entropy of the medium goes down or stays almost constant. These are histograms for the entropy change of the system. histograms for the entropy change of the medium, total entropy change histogram. We've looked at the integral fluctuation theorem. The longer trajectories are, the broader get these distributions. It's nicely obeyed. We have looked at this detailed fluctuation theorem. Okay, so this is a simple example. We've done more experiments on it on this one, but I think I'll skip those. So this is the first, I think these are the first measurements of this entropy concept. And these distributions actually contain a lot of information. Let me just show you on the next slide how such distributions could look like. This is not exactly, for the same experiment, this is not exactly the distribution of the delta S, but it's actually the distribution which would correspond to the dissipated work in this case. The black are the data, the blue are the calculation, and you can see that these distributions contain, have a lot of structure. There are these spikes. So I think the idea is that by analyzing such distributions, we might learn more about the system in more complicated cases. And we have certainly only scratched the surface here. But I think it's worthwhile not to just to look at these integral theorems, but rather look at the full distributions. And obviously, I would now like to have to see these experiments not for this defect center in diamond, which is of no biological relevance, but for really biochemical reactions. Rob?
So in the context of your defects, have you guys done loads other than periodic? And then a related comment is that, as we were discussing yesterday or whenever it was, I really think that getting the waiting time distribution for loads that are not uniform is super useful. I'm thinking about the people that do tweezers experiments on loaders and that sort of thing. It would be really helpful to have protocols where you load with temporal histories that are not linear.
Now we have done here the periodic case, which was just as a start, but I entirely agree with you. Okay, let me try to summarize. There are basically two perspectives on this work. I think these are the ingredients to what you could then call a stochastic thermodynamics for small systems. I have illustrated for mechanically driven cases, for biochemically ones, and you could speculate that the whole physics of life obviously has to obey thermodynamics also on the level of the single molecule trajectories. And then, of course, there is this other motivation and background. I think with this kind of general results, we get closer to understand non-equilibrium phenomenon in general. Okay, thanks so much for being so patient. There's no chairman. Okay, Robin.
So I'm the chair.
He is the chair. Okay.
Sorry, I'm thinking about Boris's
yes.
remark.
Yes.
So I still have this feeling that you are in the Onsager regime. Now, Boris suggested if you have an internal degree of freedom, you can go away with it. And the simplest model to do that was Prost and Jülicher, where you have a Langevin equation, but you assume there's an internal degree of freedom with two potentials, and you drive the cell. That explicitly can go away far from the Onsager regime. Yeah. Have you tried to see how your entropy production and Dzerzhinsky's theorem works for Prost and Jülicher model?
No, we haven't done that yet. I mean, I've invited everybody to come to me and with this model, and then we'll do it together. I have separated these two cases here, kind of artificially. But it's obvious, I mean, on a general level, it's obvious how you combine it. You just combine, you get this coupled Fokker-Planck master equation thing. And all the general stuff goes through, Robin.
Yeah, but it's not a simple line. It's a Langevin equation with an internal degree of freedom which flips between the
Who cares? Who cares?
And it's very rapid. It's instantaneous where you...
There's no limit on the time here. You have a rate. You have a rate to jump from one state to another one.
Do you believe that Dzerzhinsky theorem will apply to the Prost uniform model?
The appropriate extension of the Dzerzhinsky theorem, including this chemical stuff, definitely it will. I mean, or one of my relations, sure.
Just Mark? To follow up on that, although that's not what I was going to ask. I mean, you assume that there was this, that the rate of the reaction went as the concentration to the appropriate power.
Yes.
And if you have an internal degree of freedom, that would have to be modified because there might be some memory in, say, an orientation that would affect the rate.
So you're assuming that somehow the whatever local microscopic configurations can be sampled on a time short compared to the reaction.
Yes. And if you have slow ones, you have to do what Boris said. You have to add this additional degree of freedom.
Then you'd have that extra degree of freedom. You wouldn't have two species. You'd have,
I mean, you just have to decorate your model.
So the second thing was just practically, this method seems to me to be practical when the energy change is a few kT.
Yes.
And therefore very useful for many biological systems, but not necessarily for a lot of other systems where you might have 10 kT or 20 kT.
Yeah. I mean, there was this...
Practically, you can't sample the ensemble, right?
There was this recent paper in Nature by... I think it was also Bustamante's group, where they had looked at chemical reactions with the RNA, and they had even 50 kT. And by a clever way of comparing forward and backward things, they were able to, using Crookes' relation, they were able to get significant results out of that. This was in Nature just this spring or last fall. So this was even 50 kT. I mean, I was kind of surprised that it worked. Rob.
I'm a little reluctant to open my big mouth, but I'm going to do it anyway, in the sense that I want to say that that we've been thinking for a long time about an alternative way of thinking about what you're doing, which I think is great, and that is that the P log P is the Shannon entropy, and that what you're trying to do is make a best guess about the probabilities of microtrajectories based on some limited stuff of that you know.
Maybe yes.
You know a few average values on the trajectories.
Yes.
I guess I'm just trying to say that I think this is very useful,
seeing
what you're doing, and I think you have to start with beginner steps and prove that you can get the old physics that we already know.
Yes.
That doesn't invalidate doing this. I guess I'm reacting to Boris a little bit. So, you know, I don't care if I can get the same answer some other way. It's useful to show that you recover what you're supposed to.
Good. Okay. I mean, we would have to discuss about this chains approach in private, I guess. What I did not mention here, I mean, I can say something to that, but let me first make a point. I did not show you that whenever you apply this whole scheme to equilibrium, everything is entirely consistent. I mean, you get F is E minus TS on the trajectory level and everything. Now, with this approach you're advocating, my problem with this approach is, in my framework, the microscopic rates are given, and they determine everything. In your framework, you do not talk about the microscopic rates. And I think you could have two different microscopic rates, and you would still get the same estimates for the probability of the micro changes using this chains approach.
No, I don't think so. But
okay, but this is what I'd like to discuss with you. Yes.
Hugo,
yes.
Michael Fischer and Kolomeisky.
Yes.
Have a very nice model.
Yes.
They have an infinite chain of chemical reactions.
Yeah. Yeah.
The motor chain.
Yeah.
You can solve it exactly.
Yeah.
The Riemann model. Have you looked how that? So you can solve that exactly. How does your theory work?
Okay. So solve exactly typically means in these models that you get a stationary state.
Yes.
Yes, I thought about this. This is not enough here, because these are statements about the whole trajectories. And for instance, you know, suppose you expand this, expand the exponential, then you need time-dependent correlation functions in the stationary state, but taken at different times. And the experts tell me there are no decent models where you know those.
How about your second equation? That's you're looking at the trajectory has time reversal. And then checking that how it compares with your definition of stochastic entropy.
You see, it's not enough to know the stationary distribution to evaluate these probabilities. This is a statement about the whole trajectory.
But can't you, within the Riemann model, calculate the left-hand side?
I mean, you know, it was terrible work to get even the stationary. I don't think so. I don't think you could. No, I don't think you could. I talked to Herbert Spohn about it.
Matrix multiplication.
Did you learn more about the Derrida model?
How does it work for the Derrida model? Because it's an exactly solid.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very nice to have models where we know this. I mean, this is a very general constraint, but of course, important physics is in the whole distribution. And that's why I've shown you at the end in the simple two-state model where we looked at these distributions, and it would be nice to have models where we could calculate it and where it's not just a Gaussian.
Right.
I agree, but I haven't found a model yet.
Is there a quantum mechanical elephant in the room?
Yes, there is. There have been attempts to extend Yajinsky to quantum mechanics, so far not terribly successful. I think the best work is by Shaul Mukamel, who is from Irvine, just a recent quant mat. It's quite messy. It's quite messy, and I think it's not clear at all whether it's useful or not. Because this whole concept of having simple trajectories is due to entanglement. It's all much more complicated.
Intuitively, when you have dissipation, it will drive the system to the classical phase because, of course, of the wavefront.
Yeah. I mean, what you can always do, once you are at the level of a quantum master equation, then, of course, you can just, you know, feed it in here. But the tricky part is to get to that quantum master equation.
More questions?
Problems.